This is the best of the Adam Gold Show podcast, part of the Capital Broadcasting Podcast Network, brought to you by Capital Financial Advisory Group. Get your total retirement income plan by texting Adam to 21000.
All right, let's talk.
Enjoy the best of today's show. Here's Adam Gold.
Let's get going here. We are about 30 hours away from the Panthers starting 3-0 on the season and climbing even higher in the all-important power rankings, Alec. And when I say all-important, I mean not at all important.
You mean our power rankings.
And everybody's power rankings. Keyshawn Johnson's power rankings. He had the Panthers ninth. Yes. It's fine. It just doesn't matter, right? It really doesn't matter.
It's probably close.
Not really. You think they're the ninth best team in the NFL?
Yeah. I had them on my big board yesterday when we were doing power rankings. They weren't going to crack my top five. But, yeah, I mean, they're 2-0.
They are 2-0. In fact, they are.
Defense has been good.
The 49ers are 2-0. Neither of us had the 49ers on our
list. Offense is serviceable.
Yeah, so. We're going to talk about that. And we're going to hear somebody else talk about that. This is a quarterback-driven league, and the focus is always on that position. But at best, I think it's the third biggest reason why the Panthers are 2-0. Pressuring the quarterback is, to me, the number one reason that they are 2-0. 10 sacks through two games. Christian McCaffrey, to me, is the second most important reason that they are 2-0. McCaffrey with over 300 yards combined from scrimmage. Just one touchdown, but he has been awesome. 170 yards on the ground, 154 in the air.
29 touches, right?
Last
week.
Yeah, not quite what he had the week before.
Yeah, one less. He had 30 in week one. And let me ask this real fast. Kay. Is it a problem when we are writing columns about the hits that Christian McCaffrey is taking? Because Joe Person chronicled in a column after week one every hit and categorized them for Christian McCaffrey.
Do we have nicknames for the hits?
I'd have to go back and look it up. But yeah, it was like, you know, it was like a big hit. Okay. Or, you know, I can't remember the rest of them, but he categorized them all.
He doesn't take a lot of big hits. It's the most incredible thing ever.
He does pretty well with that. But at the same time, it's like, if we're even considering this, if we're writing columns about this, maybe we should be kind of taking it easy on Christian McCaffrey a little bit.
I'm not concerned about the workload when it's necessary. If I were the Panthers, I would be lessening the workload when it is not necessary. And we talked about that yesterday and Monday. Why is Christian McCaffrey running the ball with like 5 minutes left and the game is over? Those types of things we don't need to see. And number three on the list of reasons why, and this is at best because I think you could put some other things in front of this. We will go to Sam Darnold, who right now, Alec, where would you, if you had to ballpark it without looking at stats, where would you say Sam Darnold ranks among NFL?
There you go.
Without stats. Where do you think Sam Darnold ranks among NFL starting quarterbacks?
I would say at this point he's in the 15 to 20 range.
15. Yeah. Honestly, he's right about anywhere from 12 to 15. I mean, he's up there in QBR, he's top 15 in quarterback rating, passing yards, it's like 16 or so. Completion percentage is a little bit lower, but because it's, you know, there's a lot of quarterbacks that are in the mid to high 70s at this point, but he's played well. He hasn't been spectacular, but he has played well. Warren Moon, NFL Hall of Fame quarterback of the Oilers. I think he spent some time in Seattle, University of Washington, Edmonton Eskimo great. On KJM this morning on ESPN Radio, why Darnold has improved.
He just seems to be more grounded and more confident. When he was with the Jets, he just seemed jittery to me. Every time I saw him play, his feet were moving. He had those happy feet that a lot of young quarterbacks and just a lot of quarterbacks in general that aren't comfortable have. I don't see that in Carolina. I see a guy that's really confident in what he's doing. I think Joe Brady, their offensive play caller, does a great job of calling plays that he does well within that offense. They're getting him on the move and outside the pocket. And then, of course, he's got better weapons than he had in New York. So that makes his job a little bit easier. All he has to do now is be a distributor. He doesn't have to worry about making all these great throws or trying to avoid rush because he's not getting the protection that he needs, that type of thing.
He doesn't look terrified like he probably was in New York. The maturity helps. Year four helps. But look, he's in a better situation. It's not a train wreck. This coaching staff is better than any coaching staff he has ever played under. I mean, it's not as complicated as we all want it to be. All the happy feet stuff all comes from being terrified.
By the way, of McCaffrey's 30 touches in week one,
right,
4 resulted in substantial contact.
Oh, okay.
22 other plays, he was taken to the ground either by ankle, tackle, or otherwise. 4 times he ran out of bounds or was wrapped up in the play blown dead. He also had 6 pass blocking plays where he took on a defender.
Ugh. That was the best play of the game, but according to Matt Rhule.
As Joe writes, none of which looked to be a bone-rattling collision.
Joe's the best, man. Joe is the best. We'll probably talk to Joe next week. I am all on board for Sam Darnold continuing this progress. He doesn't have to be a star. He doesn't. And
quinoa.
Right, exactly.
Be quinoa.
Exactly. If the offensive line continues to get tofu, just be okay. If the offensive line can get better, then the Panthers might have something. Look, now they get to play on the road for the next 2, tomorrow against the Texans before coming back to play Dallas the following Sunday. We'll just kind of wait and see. I think we all expect this to be 3-0 after this week. Football forces us, I think, to overrate each game because there's only one a week. We have way too much time. I'm not saying you could even physically do this, but in other sports where you play multiple games a week, baseball where you basically play every day, the NHL, which Hurricanes training camp starts tomorrow morning, where you play 3 or 4 times a week, the NBA, 3, 4, maybe 5 times a week. You don't get too crazy over each outcome. But in the NFL, every single weekend is a referendum. Every one. And the truth is that 2 weeks into the NFL, and I'll even throw this forward to college football, which has played 3 weeks. For the most part, we don't know a thing. There are very few teams, and I mean this sincerely, very few teams about which we know. We just don't. So if you think you do, you are either going off of preconceived notions or you are easily swayed. We just do not have enough information at this point. If we think the best team is the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, all right. Well, explain why they probably could have, should have lost at home to Dallas in the opener. Explain that. I mean, Atlanta put up a bunch of points on them, too. So we don't know. We think we know. Every year is different. We don't even know about the Chiefs. Are the Chiefs good enough defensively? We really don't. College football, I think there's only one known, and then they went almost lost to Florida, Alabama. I don't think we have a known. Everything is up in the air. All right, speaking of up in the air, there's really no good way to transition there anyway. Chip Patterson, CBSSports.com, Cover 3 podcast, and we will work in some Ryder Cup in the second segment. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. I hope y'all are. It's a little bit stormy, around our little neighborhood right now in our little neck of North Carolina, but I'm excited about the week.
Me too. There's a lot going on. I just got notification that my son still has soccer practice. I can't figure that out, but that's fine. Maybe he'll practice indoors. All right, let me ask you this question, because I've been going back and forth with a lot of people regarding this week's college football slate, and here's my wonder. What do we really know? And we're going to focus on the ACC primarily, but what do we really know other than the ACC is almost certainly out of the playoff race?
Ooh, I don't think we know that. I think that we have to entertain the idea that 2021 is the season where we see a two-loss playoff team.
Right.
And that still might mean that Clemson does not end up as one of the top four teams, but I am broadening the scope in terms of what we think college football playoff participant, one of the top four teams, looks like as we close September and what their record is as we close September. To me, there's like, when it comes to knowing, there's three levels. There's number one, what we know based on last year. Right. There's number two, what we know based on the very small sample size that you've put together through three games, or in, I think, only like one or two teams' case, four. And then there's number three, which is if you have some insight, and the way that fans often get this is through the media. Sometimes it is poorly translated. If you have some insight into what the coaches want the team to be, because that is the most interesting when I'm looking at teams that have flaws that I believe can improve, is trying to figure out, okay, if I am this coaching staff, or if I have a way to find this information out myself from people closer to the program, you know, what do they want? Because for some teams, you are what you are. Like Clemson only has five offensive linemen right now.
Right.
That's it. They can only trust five. And when you're playing at the high level of college football, if you can only trust five offensive linemen right now, and that's not because of, you know, like recruiting issues, which offensive linemen, I know Clemson fans are always talking about, they also are banged up. Right. So it's injuries as well as competitive depth. That's a problem. And so what are you going to do with this offense, Dabo Sweeney, Tony Elliott, DJ Uiagalelei, to be able to figure it out? What is the path to being able to be successful on a weekly basis? So those three things, what you were last year, what you've shown us so far, and what we think you want to be, which again, unfortunately, is translated often poorly through media, that gives us our best idea of what we know about a team.
All right, I want to go back to my initial comment that the ACC is out of the playoff race, because I just want to drill down a little bit more. To me, Clemson is out of the playoff race.
Right, and Clemson is the ACC's playoff chances. And I agree with that.
Right, so here, and the reason is that it's not based on being 2-1. It's not even based on the fact that they only beat Georgia Tech. Well, I guess it's sort of based on the fact that they only beat Georgia Tech 14-8. They certainly have a great defense, but I have zero confidence that, first of all, their remaining schedule will only provide them one quality win, and that will, well, I shouldn't say that, because this week would be a quality win, I think.
Correct.
if they beat NC State, unless NC State finishes 7-5, in which case it ain't a quality win. So in the grand scheme of things, it might only provide them one quality win, and that would be the ACC title game, and I'm assuming at that point. But I think that maybe somebody else, and I'm not even that confident, but somebody else might have a better shot if they were to win out, and that's the team up the road in Chapel Hill. We'll get to them in a second. How does Clemson fix their offense? You have to have at least a very good offense to win a national championship or even to play in the playoff. And I don't even think they have a very good, I don't think they have a chance to get to a very good offense at this point.
I don't think you need a very good offense to make the college football playoff. I absolutely agree that to win a national championship, you need to be great. The Kelly Bryant Clemson offense was not great.
No,
and Alabama exposed that in the semifinals. Jake Browning's Washington Huskies offense was not great, and that got exposed in the college football playoff. I understand that, you know, if this offense doesn't do like leaps and bounds, like DJ Uiagalelei turns into, you know, Cam Newton, Super Cam type stuff, like we are looking at a Clemson team that, while in one conversation with you, I can say I'm not shutting the door on them making the college football playoff. I am absolutely believing that if said Clemson Tigers do make the college football playoff, that they would simply not be able to keep up against the other best teams in college football, because what we have seen year in and year out in the college football playoff era is that if you do not have the ability to make explosive plays and to just put up points, because elite offense always beats elite defense, mm-hmm. then you're just not going to go and win a national championship. I think that with the running back position, you know, Lynn J. Dixon leaves the program. Will Shipley has now emerged as your star running back.
Mm-hmm.
That is the answer to the other question, which is how do you replace Travis Etienne? Somebody who was named the ACC's best player for 2 years, including a couple of them when Trevor Lawrence was on the roster.
Right.
Trevor Lawrence won that award the final year that they were together. But he did so much out of the catching passes,
yes.
out of the backfield, being someone you could trust to go make a play on third down. That is now something that Tony Elliott and this Clemson offense, the players that they can sort of take moving forward, they still need to figure out how to put all the pieces together. So they've got a dangerous downfield passing attack. The talent is too good on the perimeter for them not to be able to do that consistently. If you don't do it against Georgia, that's fine. I really love Georgia's defense.
I do too.
If you're not doing that against Georgia Tech, it's a problem.
Yeah. Clemson has scored 17 points against FBS competition.
Correct.
And statistically speaking, their offense was very good. Even though we know Kelly Bryant was limited, statistically speaking, they were able to do things with Kelly Bryant at quarterback. Even though DJ might be better, and I have no doubt that he is better, they have not been able to produce anything offensively. Last week was, I thought, alarming. That leads me to believe that they're going to get significantly better. And I know their defense is excellent. But as you said, good offenses will always beat good defenses. So let me ask you this about the game here in Raleigh against NC State. Can NC State do enough offensively to put all sorts of pressure on Clemson to figure it out?
If the absence of starting defensive tackle Tyler Davis ends up proving to be significant in a way where NC State is able to run the ball with confidence on early downs and avoid those third and long scenarios for Devin Leary, where I think the play of NC State's wide receivers, we need to avoid as many third and long situations if I'm Tim Beck, the offensive coordinator, because I do think that Clemson will win on those downs because of what they can do from a pass rush perspective. But if you can move the ball on the ground with Bam Knight, with Ricky Person Jr., in a way that, like, I look at it and, okay, Brian Brzee, you are also a defensive tackle. And if there's any position group where Clemson can afford to lose a player, it is along the defensive line where they have seven players with starting experience
right.
from the last three seasons. But I think about Grant Gibson. I think about Ikem Ekwonu. I think about this NC State offensive line. If you can set up some of those third and manageable instead of a third and nine situation, then you're going to keep a James Skalski. You're going to keep some of those linebackers from being able to rush the passer, because Clemson might not respect NC State's wide receivers to win one-on-one battles on the outside. And if I am NC State's offensive coordinator, I would prefer not to have proving them wrong as my game plan. I would really prefer to be able to run the ball consistently. So if NC State can establish the running game against a very, very good Clemson defense, then it becomes extremely interesting.
Do you like State plus 10 points at home?
I do. I'm just not going to end up on the other side of that after I was a win and a half higher on their win total. It was set at 6.5, and I had them going 8-4. I'm like a little bit higher, less so now, but a little bit higher than most of your average power ratings when
right.
I'm crunching my numbers in terms of how many points you are better than the average FBS team. And so if I'm going to be like on the front end of this, like, heck yeah, like I'll go down with the ship. This might be the Clemson get right game.
NC State fans are convinced that it is.
I know, because dread lives in the hearts of NC State fans. So I just, I'm not going to be trying to claim this as the Clemson get right game in a way that's going to cause so much pain and agony to my friends. So I'm just going to stick with what my numbers say. This is a good NC State team. This should be a touchdown spread.
Is this a crossroads game for Dave Doran? They have
North
won.
Carolina. North Carolina at the end of the year is bigger crossroads to me.
You
just
think?
Because of, yeah, the emotional side of it.
They have won. They literally in 8 years. And I think I think two things can be true here. I think the program is in good shape. I like Dave Doran. I think they've done a very good job, especially in preparing players for the next level. There's a ton of NC State talent in the National Football League. But they have, I mean, literally, they have won zero games in 8 years that inspire their fan base.
So they haven't had North Carolina carrying a high ranking for all that long.
Right.
And that's why I say the North Carolina, because North Carolina is the confluence of beating a ranked team or a highly ranked team, and also it's North Carolina, which is why it feels like more of a crossroads than Clemson to me. But the lack of the wins against ranked and highly ranked teams in, you know, a spot like this is certainly become part of the discussion around, mm-hmm. you know, what NC State is. I personally, the Mississippi State egg makes that conversation a lot tougher, but I still think that you take the high floor program that's churning out NFL draft picks, right, as opposed to one that has the wild variance of congratulations, you beat Florida State, but then you lost to Virginia.
Right, but it I would rather, like, let me ask you this question, because I know we are going to talk golf next segment. As a golfer, would you rather make 9 pars in a row, or would you rather make 3 birdies, 3 bogeys, and 3 pars?
I do love when I'm just filling up the scorecard with pars and bogeys, just churning along.
So you don't want the birdie? You don't want 3 birdies? Same score. Same score. 9 pars versus 3 birdies, 3 bogeys, and 3 pars?
I think so.
Really? Give me the birdies, man. Give me the birdies.
I don't know. I could. The problem is I haven't been playing enough to actually have like a great like time to check in on this.
I wasn't trying to like apply our own. Hell, I'd take 9 pars in them every single day.
Oh, I wasn't talking about that. I'm saying, like, even my mentality in terms of the way that I approach staring at a scorecard. It's been a lot of, churning out multi-platform excellence from the Palatial Patterson Studios, and not a lot of trying to keep my eye on the ball and finish high, you know?
All right, let me move on to I like State plus the points. I would love to see them beat the Tigers, and I think that they are ripe for it. I don't think it does them any good to lose close. I really don't. It doesn't accomplish anything to lose close. If you have a chance to win the game, you better win it. Carolina, who looked terrible at Virginia Tech, I completely throw out whatever happened against Georgia State. Then in the first half, defense worried me, but second half, they continued to do crazy things offensively, and Virginia was shut down. So what do you know about North Carolina at this point?
That Virginia Tech was not representative of the team that it is, and that the bet that North Carolina's offense would be better at the end of the year than it is at the beginning of the season, or that it was on that first Friday, is already paying off. And while you can nitpick to the point of, you know, trying to find, you know, who among those other receivers is going to really threaten opposing defenses, you know, Coffrey Brown comes up with a couple big catches. Josh Downs remains your alpha in that wide receiver room.
He's great.
The numbers that stand out to me are, what was it, 392 team rushing yards with like 198 of them for Ty Chandler.
Yeah, they were really good running the ball. They opened up tons of holes.
Yeah, that's something that should give the offensive line some confidence, because that's, you know, we have a certain set of standards, regardless of what the scores are, of, you know, where a Bronco Mendenhall Virginia defense is going to be, what they're going to look like, how they're going to play, and to be able to move the ball consistently on the ground. I thought that was a a great shot across the bow to the rest of the Coastal, you know, saying, yeah, like we do, North Carolina does have a loss, but they're saying to the rest of the division is like, but we don't plan on losing another division game.
Right. And if they don't, and again, their schedule is not going to beat them up. They catch a break. Look, not that it's going to be easy. I mean, Pitt's not going to be easy. I still can't figure out how you lose at home to Western Michigan and give up.
Because it's Pitt.
Right,
I mean, Pitt might beat Clemson. Like, Pitt's going to lose to Western Michigan and then beat Clemson in late October.
You're probably right, Chip Patterson. What do you last thing, like, real quick on both of these games, and I have one football thing hanging over. What do you make of Duke and the win over Northwestern? I loved it in the first half. To me, they were just kind of hanging on and taking advantage of poor quarterback play in the second half.
Yeah, Northwestern's really, really bad. What I make of Duke is I'm a little bit nervous about the way that game ended.
Yeah.
And I am very hopeful for Duke's sake that there was a nice, like, refresh, reboot, a lot of, like, hard, you know, just sort of looking in the mirror and making sure that doesn't happen again. Yeah. Because you went from that, it was supposed to be very competitive. It did not look like it was going to be, eventually was very competitive. Lance Leipold is a good coach, and Kansas hasn't quit. They're bad. They're really, 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 really bad.
Right.
But if Duke plays four quarters like it played the fourth quarter against Northwestern, they are in a dangerous spot to get beat. And so for all the things that Duke has done well to continue to move this thing forward, and they are a 16-point favorite.
No way.
They should win.
Yeah, no.
But I'm just saying, if you play four quarters against Kansas, a Kansas team that has not quit yet, then you're going to find yourself in a very tight spot late in the fourth quarter.
Wake Forest at Virginia. I said it a number of times last week, I thought Wake would run Florida State. Wake's got an elite offense. I don't know about their defense, which worries me going to Charlottesville, because I think Virginia will be able to score on them. I would expect, barring massive amounts of turnovers, the over will be a lock. What do you make of that?
It's a tricky spot for the Demon Deacons, especially no matter where Florida State is, you still just beat Florida State in your Wake Forest. Like, it still carries a little bit of meaning, and I expect that Virginia is going to be a very, very angry team. I kind of think that they are very similar in terms of how good they can be this season. For Wake Forest, you just have to be able to move on, because if we look at the previous week's results and play them forward, then Virginia wins this game, because Virginia needs to figure out a way to get back on track, and Wake Forest might still be lingering in last week. The thing that has impressed me the most about Wake Forest's, you mentioned their offense being very, very good, is that we can't bet on who in this Wake Forest offense is going to be the dynamic wide receiver. And that really speaks to the evaluation of Dave Clawson and the offensive staff, because we come into every year, we're like, all right, this is going to be the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Surprise. No, it's one of these two other
somebody
guys.
Somebody else.
And it's like different players each game. It's different players throughout the course of a season. The way that they evaluate the wide receiver position within the context of that offense, and the way that they teach the quarterback to take advantage of ideal matchups. You know, I came into this season, I think I had Ja'Cari Robinson as first team all ACC player. What, do you only have like three catches against Florida State? And some of that might be Florida State, you know, trying to take out the most talented wide receiver, but still to be able to put up those kind of numbers. The reason why Wake Forest is in the position it is, and is in such a great position with Dave Clawson, like, as long as Wake makes Dave Clawson happy, I think Dave Clawson will continue to make Wake happy, because his system is put in place and it just works right now.
Shane Ryan for Golf Digest wrote the following, you put this team in front of 40,000 rabid home fans every day. There is only one sensible conclusion: America is going to win, and it probably won't be close. He is doing a book on the Ryder Cup, the Ryder Cup Run podcast. I listened to episode 4 this morning, which is the prediction podcast. and he joins us from Whistling Straits. A couple of weeks ago, I do not think you would have selected the United States to win. What changed your mind?
Hey, how you doing, Adam? Yeah, you know, it's funny with the Ryder Cup. There's so little information to get. And then by the time you get to Ryder Cup week, you get a little bit more information. And I think that's what changed my mind. I kind of saw the thing Steve Stricker was doing. I think he's preparing really well. I think he made really good captain's picks. And I just think his team, he's creating this sort of predictable environment for his team, which is good because a lot of times we've seen captains in the past Ryder Cups fail because they throw curveballs at the last second and things like that. And so, yeah, I just like the way he's I like the way he's dealing with his team. And I think home course advantage is enormous with the fans and the way you can control the setup of the course. And so, you know, I looked at the last six Ryder Cups and I said, well, other than one crazy result in Medina in Chicago on a Sunday, the home team really seems to dominate. And so if you don't see any red flags, you're kind of crazy not to go with the home team. And then finally, there's just the fact that the U.S. players are better. So that all led me to this conclusion. I feel confident about it, and I'm fully ready to be completely wrong when things start on Friday.
Being better has not always been a good predictor for the United States. There have been some tremendous teams that laid, I mean, enormous eggs. 2004 with Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson, number one and two in the world. That did not go well at Oakland Hills in Michigan. But what is it about these rookies? What is it about what Steve Stricker has done? And I am frankly amazed at because we talked to Mike Hicks yesterday, and Mike Hicks said this will be over by 3 o'clock on Sunday. I'm like, wow. I don't want to watch the 4 o'clock football games. So what is it about the captain's picks and Steve Stricker that leads you down this road?
I think the biggest thing is that, you know, 2014 happened in Glen Eagles, and if you're a big golf fan like we are, Adam, you know. What a complete disaster that was for the U.S. Tom Watson did everything wrong, and Paul McGinley for the Europeans did everything right. And it created this situation where the U.S. was almost forced because it was so bad to act. So they did this task force, which we all kind of made fun of because task force is a funny name for a golf committee, right? But
right.
I think they did some really good things. I think they really started to look at what the Europeans had done, but more importantly, kind of look at their own team. And so, you know, to give you a couple examples, I think they really chose their captain's picks based on who's going to play well at the course, which is smart. You probably saw the Brooks Koepka interview in Golf Digest where he talked about all the obligations that people have and how Ryder Cup week is no fun for the Americans. And so they cut a lot of those out. And, you know, COVID gave Steve Stricker a nice assist on that this year because it's a good excuse, you know, no galas, no, you know, black tie dinners, no obligations like that. They're just hanging out as a team. And I think one of the really big obstacles is just a cultural one where, you know, Europe is better at playing as a team. I mean, I think both sides really want to win very badly. But the Americans, especially Americans who golf, which is an individual sport and attracts a certain kind of person from a certain kind of background, maybe.
Right.
It makes it very difficult for them to gel as a team, where the Europeans are good at that. And so in order to compete with them and in order to beat them, A, you've got to be better, which they usually are. But like you said, that's not good enough all the time. Being better on paper, but B, you've got to, everything, all the distractions, everything that makes it unpleasant have to be cut out. You've got to give them a comfortable sort of setting. And then, you know, the last thing is probably the Americans over the last 30 years, they probably need to be at home to win. And they are. So, you know, I think this, everything is going right from what I'm seeing, so far that I feel really comfortable thinking, you know, just like the last five Ryder Cups, Americans will run up a big lead. And, as long as nothing wild happens on Sunday, I'm foreseeing a sort of 15.5 to 12.5 or 16-12 win.
Would you consider that a route?
Yeah, I think so. I would call it a predictable route, put it that way. I wouldn't think it would be any kind of disaster for Europe if that happened. And I should say, you know, all this stuff, if America loses this, it is a disaster for the U.S. I mean, really, they have to win this Ryder Cup, I think. I think of it as a must win. But yeah, a route, a mild route. It wouldn't be like some of the 18.5 to 9.5 ones
from
the Europeans and the U.S. in, you know, 2004 and 2006. But still, yeah, a good solid victory.
I mean, 18.5, 9.5, those results are like getting beat, you know, 70-3 on a football field. I mean, these are.
Yeah.
I mean, go ahead.
I was just going to say, even more, 70-3 a game between two teams that are supposed to be competitive.
Right, you know, not like exactly.
Versus like backwards Tennessee, middle whatever. It's like, you know, Georgia and Florida playing and ends up 70-3.
How much of your feeling about the way this the outcome you predict, and I don't know that you're wrong. The closer we get to it, the more I look on at the players and think, man, the United States really has no business losing this. They're longer, straighter, better putters by and large than everybody on the European side, other than maybe Jon Rahm. They probably have better talent top to bottom, they definitely do, than anybody not named Jon Rahm. But how much of this is also due to the fact that Rory has been good but not great, and that nobody else, Tommy Fleetwood's probably not a good player for this golf course, Tyrrell Hatton not long enough, Matthew Fitzpatrick, this is a bad golf course for him, even Ian Poulter, it's probably not long enough to really be a great player on this course. How much of it is also it's not a good spot for the Europeans?
Yeah, you know, everybody talks about, oh, it's a links, it looks like a links course, but it's really not. it's going to benefit them, I will say, if the wind blows. But yeah, your point is exactly right. This is not a deep team. It's a very old team. It's not an incredibly long team, especially compared to the Americans. And yeah, I mean, you know, you look at the U.S. side, maybe the one guy you say is a little bit out of form is Colin Morikawa. But
right.
You point to five guys. You know, it's Hatton, Fitzpatrick, Westwood. I mean, there's a ton of guys in Europe that just aren't playing well. And that's something, you know, that can be a big deal, especially when you're on a course that, you know, gosh, if you're Lee Westwood or Poulter or whoever, and you're going against Dustin Johnson or Brooks Koepka, you're already starting behind the eight ball because these guys are crushing drives that, in, you know, in ways that are not available to you.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that's a great point. It is. Again, I always try to be wary of going, hey, we've got better players, because like you said, it's not always worked out in the past, to put it mildly. But I think that is a big deal this year as well.
Yeah, I mean, having the better team, especially because the world rankings are so skewed to the U.S. Tour, although I would submit that almost everybody on the European team plays just about exclusively on the European Tour. Shane Ryan from Golf Digest, at Shane Ryan here on Twitter, is joining us on the Adam Gold Show. Give me the player on the European side that must be a star for them to have a chance.
Well, I'll give you two, and it's easy. It's Rory and Jon Rahm. I mean, these are the guys that are on that elite level that a lot of the Americans are on, and without them, you can forget it. You know, if Jon Rahm, you told me Jon Rahm's going 1-3 or 1-2-1 or something like that, definitely not good enough. I would just bet everything on the Americans. So those two guys have to lead the way. I think that's where it starts. You know, if you're only looking at a couple players, it's them.
I'm going to throw one other in there, because for Europe to win, those two guys must be givens. I think they, because sure, at some point you're going to have to ride the guys who can hit it far. Victor Hovland has to be great. I mean, there's just no other option. And Sergio Garcia must be great. If those guys play well, then I think this is going to be a really, really tight match.
Well, that's, you know, sort of proves the point a little bit, where you're saying a rookie from Norway has to be great.
Or, yeah.
Or you're doomed. You know, I mean, that's a lot to ask. And he might be. He might be. There's a funny story where Patrick Harrington, as a lot of captains do, you know, told his guys, tell me everyone you want to play with and then everyone you don't want to play with. And they don't give away those secrets. But one thing he did say on Irish radio was that all 11 other players said, yes, they want to play with Victor Hovland, which is the only guy like that. So he's great. And he's got a great personality. And I like him a lot. But, you know, geez, you throw a guy into the cauldron who's never done it before. And by the way, he's never had anyone from his country do it before.
Right.
And go, yeah, geez, we need 4 points from you or else. that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, but Suzanne Pettersson, she made the winning putt at a Solheim Cup a couple of years ago. Shane Ryan, before we let you go, I know you and I have talked before about Brooks and Bryson. So I have no problem. They're going to be fine. I am not worried about that. I think maybe too much is being made about that. Bryson looks like he's happier than he has been in 6 months in terms of his demeanor, doing interviews, walking around the golf course. Would you play Bryson right away in foursomes Friday morning?
No. I think the best way to use Bryson and to take the pressure off of is to say, here's the deal. We're going to play you with Scottie Scheffler twice in four ball. And you know, then you're going to play in singles. And that's all you got to do is deliver 3 points for us. Bam, that's it. Don't get him out there in foursomes. It's not a great format for him, I don't think. Certainly can. You know, I'm not saying he's a great golfer. He can do it if he needs to. But I think if you limit the scope of what he has to do, give him a very specific target to aim for and say, these are your 3 points, bring all three to us and we're not going to lose this Ryder Cup, that's the way to handle it.
I mean, could you imagine, though, what your foursomes would be if Bryson was hitting it in the fairway and Justin Thomas was wedging it to 5 feet?
Oh, yeah, amazing. Or Colin Morikawa. Yeah. I mean, and it'd be interesting to know Justin Thomas and Bryson DeChambeau in yesterday's practice pairings broke away from Spieth and Scheffler and kind of played on their own. So it's not what you just described is not out of the realm of possibility. Although I do think Thomas and Spieth is probably a lock for at least the first two sessions on Friday.
It would be to me, it would be a little bit of a roll of the dice, but if it came up seven, then I think that's where your route is. Because I think Bryson could play five matches. He's got to get ready for the long drive competition anyway. That's his priority. At Shane Ryan here. The Ryder Cup Run podcast is great if you're a Ryder Cup junkie, as I am. I love it, and you can read him in Golf Digest and check out the book. People can pre-order the book. You've already sent the link out.
Yeah, people pre-order the book. It's good. The publishing people say it's good to get pre-orders. So, yeah, if you end up liking the podcast or you're interested in Ryder Cup stuff, it's out there for you on all the normal bookseller places.
At Shane Ryan here on Twitter. Thank you, man. I appreciate it. Have fun.
All right, Adam. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the best of the Adam Gold Show podcast. Part of the Capital Broadcasting Podcast Network. Brought to you by Capital Financial Advisory Group. Get your total retirement income plan by texting Adam to 21000. Don't forget, this podcast drops every weekday at 3 p.m. Or you can find it at WRALSportsFan.com, the WRAL Sports Fan app. Or you can subscribe for free at the iTunes and Google Play stores.